Right now, it is time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David joins us on a Friday morning. He has his own terrific website, themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And once again, we get a long-distance David this morning. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Yes, I'm reporting in not from my usual base of New York City, the media capital of the world, but I'm still in Ireland and glad to be here, glad to be reporting in once more, joining the persistent questioner, Marshall Miles. I want to talk about persistent questioning today. Can I report? Actually, just before I do that, can I just comment on a follow-up from last week's The Media Beat?
Sure.
A bit of local news, local Connecticut news. We were talking about the protest against the closure of the island's Great Hunger Museum at Quinnipiac University. Well, it's a news item of great interest from Connecticut, but resonating through Ireland now. And the new development is that since we talked last week, now the Attorney General of Connecticut, William Tong, has launched an investigation into the closure of that museum, a museum that is dear to the hearts, of course, to many Irish Americans and of course, to the Irish back here in Ireland itself.
All right. Hopefully, cooler heads will prevail, and it won't be closed down. Hopefully.
What the protesters are hoping for, of course, is a change of mind. Yeah. But we'll see if that happens. But at the very least, they want the collection in that museum to be kept whole and not split up and sold. Last thing they want, of course, is for it to be sold off. But anyway, that's that in Connecticut. Here in the British Isles, I need to put in a plea for a better name to be coined for this geographical entity where I'm currently based. The label British is just not correct anymore. That labeling hasn't caught up with modern history. I mean, since the early part of last century, one of the two main islands that make up these isles, the one to the west, the left-hand one, as you look at it on a conventional map, the one you come to first when crossing the Atlantic from the USA, as I just have, this island comprises in the main, in fact, 5/6 of it comprise a wholly separate, independent country from Britain. It's the Republic of Ireland, where I am. So let's not forget that. Nor the inaccuracy of sloppily calling this whole cluster of islands the British Isles. It's just not all British. Anyway, having got that bit of pedantry off my chest, let's acknowledge that the biggest news in these islands at this time comes from Glasgow in the more northern part of the other isles, in Scotland, of course. Not an independent country like Ireland, or not yet, as many Scots would say, since in a lot of people's view, it's decidedly tending in that direction toward independence from the UK. But Glasgow, as you'll know, is currently firmly on the world map for an event chaired by the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, the World Climate Change Summit, COP26, talking about labels. That's an awkward one. It just means the Conference of Parties, parties to the agreement made in Paris, on climate change measures, all getting much more serious now. And this is the 26th such meeting, happens to fall in Glasgow. But I have to report that this big global news has been overshadowed by domestic events here, in Britain at the least, some gross political mishandling of important matters by Prime Minister Johnson and his closest political companions. And it's been an opportunity, I should say, for some very good journalism to be practiced. And at this point, I'd like to sound our fanfare in celebration of some good journalistic work. There it is, our fanfare. There's been some very energetic British media coverage of what's being called sleaze, wonderful word that in journalistic circles. The sleaze among the Johnson crowd. You need a bit of background first, Marshall, about a close confederate of Bojo, as many call Johnson, including our own colleague Jill Goodman, doesn't she? She calls him Bojo.
Yep.
we're talking about a Johnson crony here, to quote some papers, who's a former cabinet minister. He's been a member of parliament and by the way, was once the boss of Boris Johnson's wife. He's called Owen Paterson, but you don't especially need to know his name. The important thing about him is that he was censured by Parliament's disciplinary body. He was found guilty of doing what members of Parliament are expressly forbidden not to do. Forbidden to do what he did, which was to accept money from outside interests, commercial companies, in fact, for carrying out lobbying inside the government and the Parliament on behalf of those commercial interests. When he was found guilty, Boris and his other powerful friends all closed ranks in support of him and made moves to actually abolish the disciplinary process in Parliament and replace it with a whole new body, which looked to everybody suspiciously weighted in favor of Boris's own people. So inevitably, all hell broke out in Parliament and in the press protesting against this. But Boris stuck to his guns. Until he didn't. This is where journalism played a big part here. Boris's Secretary for Business, a man called Kwasi Kwarteng, was wheeled out to defend the government's dubious position on a BBC radio program called Today. It's the morning version and radio. It's the morning radio version in Britain of the NBC Today show, I suppose, but not so frothy. Very serious journalism most of the time. And frankly, when the business secretary, Kwasi Kwarteng, came onto the Today program in Britain, he gave a very dubious defense for what he was there to defend. Talk about persistent questioning, as I was crediting you with when we started. You'd have been proud, I think, Marshall, of this interview. Nick Robinson, that Today Show's co-host, who's specifically, individually, I think, earned our fanfare this week, he pressed the cabinet secretary for business, on matters of probity and ethics, which is the British phrase, probity and ethics in public life, and what is seen as Johnson's contempt for such matters. The interviewer asked at one point for a specific example of Johnson ever upholding probity and ethics. And the poor hapless official, he gave a dismal offering. Essentially, he just said, well, the Prime Minister said he'd take Britain out of Europe, and with Brexit, he did take Britain out of Europe. He kept his word. That amounts, in Johnson circles anyway, as an example of probity and ethics. But Boris obviously evidently heard this fiasco. The minister's performance was, as I say, dismal. And overnight, Boris completed an entire U-turn. The plan for the new disciplinary body in Parliament was dropped, and the guilty member of Parliament felt forced to resign completely. On his way out, incidentally, he decried what he called the cruel world of politics. I guess it hadn't seemed too all that cruel when he was accepting what I think was reported to be $125,000 when we convert to U.S. currency, $125,000 a year from big food manufacturers and a major healthcare company. So it's a good example, I think, of journalism doing its job in the political arena.
And you know, we have a couple of news organizations that do have the wherewithal and the budget and the depth to do that type of reporting, which is more than ever not only what we need here in the United States, but you're right, throughout the world. I mean, that type of reporting that actually brings to light something, that brings change, proper change, is what reporting has all been about over the years.
Yeah, and in broadcasting especially, when you may not be the organization, you may not be the organization that does the legwork and produces the expose that makes the big breaking news. But in following it up, which broadcast news often does behind newspapers in particular, that old pattern still prevails. Broadcasting tends to do the follow-up. It gets the responsible official and grills them. And in this case, it was a classic case, an absolutely classic case, of a public official being held to account. And the business, in this case, the business secretary was called to account for a bad bit of business policy, and a particularly egregious bit of rules meant to prevent business having outsized and undue influence over public policy was thoroughly aired, and the result is there in the public record now. One member of parliament left parliament, and there's now going to be an election to replace him. But as you say, this is what journalism does all over the world when it's doing its best. And in some countries, it's badly needed. I mean, I'm thinking at the moment of the really hard struggles that journalists are having to pursue this kind of work in places like Poland or Hungary or, of course, Myanmar and Hong Kong and all the other places that we talk about almost every week now, when journalism is trying to do its best to call oppressive public authority to account.
You know, you mentioned something a little earlier, and I want to go to it, and that is the thousands of youth that are now at the Youth Climate March. To me, it's inspirational that they're getting involved and that they're not just getting involved, but actively pursuing and trying to convince governments all across the world that, hey, don't hand us a world that's dead. Are you there, David? I think we lost David. We're going to have to give him a call back. We lost him. All right, let's do this. I can do this. I know I can. I have the technology. Let's see here. See if this works. And we'll go like this.
Oh, I'm sorry that we got cut off there. I'm back with you now, I hope.
Yes, you are. And what I was leading into is I'm very impressed with the youth at the Youth Climate March, how they're not only getting involved in raising their voices, but actually doing things to try to change governments to hand them over a world that is not dead by the time they're adults.
Sure. The youth have certainly been a lot more energized by these issues of climate change and the need to combat it more than any other group in every just about every nation's popular makeup. I mean, the fact that the young heroine Greta has spoken for her entire generation across not just Europe, where she speaks often in different countries, but across the world in general. The youth crowding together in support of combating climate change to coincide with the Glasgow summit, mainly British youth, of course, but there are youth from all over the world amassing and making their voices heard. And it plays no small part in the way that government policy is formed. I think any sensible administration in any democratic country is going to have to look to the up and coming generations if they're not going to lose their own electoral support in the future. And if only for that cynical purpose of retaining the power that they currently hold. They're going to have to listen. And one of the interesting things that the British government has done while playing host to this summit is to ensure that every single day, this is a bit of press management, I guess you'd call it, but you can see the point of them doing it. Every day is a new theme in which they have, in the main, got a major statement to put out, and a major statement about an agreement or a new finding that demonstrates the need for the changes that are being discussed. Like, for instance, first day was a very large and substantial, and I think ultimately very significant agreement between nations as a whole against deforestation, and that was followed the next day by agreement about financing procedures and measures to encourage private commercial business to get on board with the anti-global warming policy shifts that are needed. And consequently, right through the week, we can expect this to go on from the British government. And they have a view, of course, in making each one of these announcements, they have a view to the population as a whole, and they know that the liveliest response is going to be amongst the younger set.
You know, another story that we talked about a little bit with China and their housing crisis. Well, guess what? Another huge corporation, I think it's Caixa Company, they missed their payment, and now there's real fears that have even grown in China that this is going to put really unprecedented pressure on finances in that economy, which is rolling along halfway decent right now.
Sure, the growth projected for the Chinese economy already is the second biggest economy in the world, moving ahead leaps and bounds, even though, of course, it was slowed by the pandemic originating in China. And what we'll see now, I think, is a something of a dent, even though it may only be temporary, but you never know. It's hard to make economic predictions in this very shaken world business system that's happened in the wake of the global pandemic. Britain, I'm here to report that in these so-called British Isles, there's a crisis just as there is in the United States of the chain supply for business as a whole, getting products that are made in other parts of the world delivered in anything like a timely basis is proving more and more difficult and is sending costs soaring, contributing to the concerns about inflation that are rampant here in Britain as well as in the United States. And it's all a reflection, I think, of the major damage caused on a global scale. And China discovering, I mean, even in its very strong position, that it has these patches of weakness. I mean, it's examples of overreaching, if you like, in economic growth. All the extraordinary money that was poured into new construction and the extraordinary mushrooming of real estate companies like the ones that have gotten into trouble. And that will have, it is already having its impact upon the money markets. People are very jittery about China's performance overall. And if it goes on like this, it's bound to have greater repercussions around the world.
And I want to go back here to the United States, and this amazed me when I read about this morning. In Georgia, they have selected a nearly all-white jury with only one black member in the Georgia murder of three white men shooting a black jogger in 2020. The judge noted that he thought it was intentional discrimination, but he's allowing the trial to go on. You know, people in this country want to know why. African Americans, Black Americans don't see the advances. This is why. You just can't have a jury selected with one black member and the rest white members in a case so volatile as this.
Sure. It sends a message. Certainly that's been picked up here, the other side of the Atlantic. This is the kind of report that gets America yet again a bad name when it comes to race relations. It is so evidently a gross miscarriage of the procedure, the old principle of the trial by one's peers, and that means, of course, the whole principle of a judgment by your peers is that juries should reflect the community as a whole. And to cherry pick the members of the jury, as in this case the defense was able to do, and that right should always be used, But in this case, it seems quite clear to be, you know, have been abused quite clearly, and that message is being blared out to the world at large. It's very obvious that American justice is under the magnifying glass as this case proceeds, rather like, in, you know, for different issues, the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse in Wisconsin going on concurrently. Is showing up the weaknesses of American justice when it comes to racial matters.
All right, and let's go to Washington for just a moment. Really, it appears that the Democrats are no closer to putting together the package they need to move forward on two of Joe Biden's really essential packages that he wants to present to the American people that involve just about everything he talked about in the election.
Sure. Well, back at home, I know that there's a lot of skittishness amongst the Democratic Party. I mean, there are the defeats and near defeats that the Democrats suffered at state level on Election Day, November 2nd. It's not exactly the shellacking that Obama, you remember, said he received in the midterms during his first term, or the thumping that George W. Bush called it when he had it during his second term. But these setbacks are decidedly a bracing experience for the Democratic Party. You know, we do have now, I mean, as we speak on Friday, there'll be a test in the House of Representatives for Biden's, what is it, $1.85 trillion package for that combines the social safety net, climate measures, and tax changes legislation. We'll see if the more centrist Democratic members of the House are spooked enough by Tuesday's results to hold the bill up further and maybe try to, and well, in all likelihood they will try to diminish its scope and its costs. I mean, how fearful, the question is, how fearful are these centrists that the public wants to punish such democratic attempts at what's historically been called big spending, big government? You might argue that if ever there was a time for big spending by government, it would be now in the wake of the pandemic. But that's not enough to persuade certain elements of the Democratic Party who fear, of course, that they'll be displaced by Republicans and they'll have their own shellacking or something. So we'll have to wait and see how that pendulum swings on Capitol Hill.
All right, and we're going to wrap up with an odd story, a story that I opened my eyes. The mayor-elect of New York City, where you normally do your broadcast from, Eric Adams, has now said he'd like his first three paychecks in Bitcoin. And he said that because he wants to make New York the center of the cryptocurrency industry.
Well, that will be interesting. Wall Street is not known for taking such bold steps. Bold, you might say, reckless steps. There's one thing that this new mayor is not conventional. I mean, it's conventional in other ways. I think some of the characteristics he displays are those of certain kind of politicians we've seen time and time again. He prides himself on his populism and his capacity for being different from his predecessor, let's put it that way. And one of the things he's been trying to ensure is that the message goes out that New York will be much more business-friendly under this new Democratic mayoral regime. We'll see about that, I guess.
All right, and the one piece of good news really is that Pfizer has come out with an experimental pill, and it looks like it works. And what it does is it, almost in 90% of the cases, it actually cures and helps push down COVID-19 from people that get that disease. That this is, to me, a far bigger breakthrough than the vaccines.
Sure, it looks like an active treatment. I mean, not just a countermeasure or a preventive measure. but something that might actually banish the government, banish the COVID as a disease in individual people, and of course, you know, build up maybe a body of people who have been cured. It would change the map considerably if that turns out to be as fulfilling as their hopes seem to be.
David, it's always great to speak to you. Have a good week, and we'll speak to you next week.
And I'll be back in New York by then. I'll look forward to that.
All right. David Terechuk with the Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network.